Carlos Jefe. Mi nombre es Rafael Juan. Amiga, ¿quién entra?
What are we going to talk about tonight? Any helpers? You say you're going to talk about
tonight. What are we going to talk about tonight?
It's knocking down to infinity.
Words.
Words? Oh, my God. We'll talk about words. First, we'll take the word word. There is a book. Considered to be a very intelligent book called The Meaning of Meaning, No Riches. It's a very long book that doesn't start by telling you the meaning of the first meaning. If you have the meaning of meaning without defining the first meaning, it gives you a nice long book. The problem is not strictly solved at the end of it. We're going to say that words are primarily sounds, and that the printing symbols that we use for these sounds have evolved from certain drawings of ideas, that the ideas were signified by sounds originally, and that the symbols have some relationship to the original sound. For instance, the vowel O can only be formed by making your mouth in the form of an O. If you make your mouth in any shape other than round, it won't make the sound O. So the sound O has a written symbol which merely represents the lips rounded. So the visible symbol corresponds with the physical position of the vocal organs during the production of that sound. So it has a similar meaning to the rounded lips. If you get hold of the feeling that you have when you round your lips and then speak through rounded lips, the sound that you hear will correspond with the visual impression given by the circle of the lips. So we can say that the vowel O is both visually and sonically corresponding. Now, some of the letters we might find rather less easy to observe. And let's take another one, the vowel I. The Greeks don't put a dot on it. And some Greek scholars think that non-Greeks who put dots on it are dotty, and that it's quite unnecessary. But in fact, the original letter is a dot, which is in the Hebrew simply a little squiggle with a tail on, which could be drawn as a spiral. Now, every dot, every jot of matter in the universe is really a force that has spiraled in and tightened itself. From the point of view of economy, instead of drawing a spiraling force, turning inwards and finishing up tightly packed, we can just indicate the tightly packed bit as a dot, a jot, a jota, and so on. You can see then that the Greeks might have had another reason for using a vertical line to represent it. Namely, a bit of dirt on the paper might be mistaken for the letter. And if you make a very definite mark, it's less likely that that would happen. You know, some musicians play odd bits of dirt on the music, and the conductors don't like it. So it wasn't a bad idea of the rational Greeks to turn the dot into a line to avoid reading bits of dirt on the paper. But really, the letter is a dot. It's the iota of the Greeks, the English word jot, the Hebrew yod, where it's simply using D instead of T. Both dentals, one voiced, one whispered. D is voiced, T is whispered. Like the O, this little dot has a physical correspondence. When you want to pronounce the vowel im, as in jitterbug, the jit and the im, you actually hold your tongue in such a way that there's very, very little space between the tongue and the palate. To pronounce a long e, which of course you wouldn't find pronounced long in English, but you would in any other continental language. If you see the English letter I in a continental word, it is pronounced E. Whereas our English letter E in a continental word, French, Italian and so on, is pronounced A. Something like a good Yorkshire A. So this little dot is made by trying to make a little space as big as a dot between your tongue and your palate. So just as you have the round lips for O, so you make a very tiny little space for E. Try and make a little short E, and you'll feel that you're constricting yourself in the tongue, between the tongue and the palate. Properly pronounced, this little sharp E can be felt as a little tiny thing, which is why Christ refers to this jot, or tittle, which shall not pass away till all be fulfilled. We can say it is the smallest letter sounded. And just like a dot or jot signifies the littlest thing, so the vowel e signifies a little thing. That is why it occurs in the word little. If you say lottle instead, it doesn't sound quite right. If you said, I've got a lottle pudding on my plate, you get an image of a large dot. And if you say a little, then the amount shrinks. So you see an actual correspondence between the sound, the physical position of your vocal organs in making it, and the symbolic value of both.
Excuse me, can I interrupt you?
Do.
If you can pronounce the I in a different way, so it's long, and you get quite a gap in between the tongue and
you mean
alive.
Where is it? Do you mean the symbol? This symbol pronounced as in the English I.
Yes.
The English vowel I is a diphthong, pronounced with the letter R, which is written like this, which English people would call A, and the letter E, R-E, I, you see? You must learn to distinguish between the vowels as used in English, which are frequently diphthongs, like A, E, A, as in rain, I and ride, and so on. And pure continental vowels, like Italian vowels. If we saw this in Italian, we would say A or A. Short A, long A. If we saw A, E, I, or U, those would be the correct symbols used by phoneticians. If you look at the Phonetique International symbols, you'll find these letters are pronounced A, E, I, or U. But in English, because English is super diplomats, they won't say much clearly if they can avoid it. So when they see this sign, they make a diphthong and they say E, I, A. And when they see this sign, they say A, E, I. And when they see this sign, they say O, U, O, these two together. When they see this on its own, they say E, U, U. So all the English equivalents are diphthongs because the English see things double. They're diplomats, or devil faces. So we would expect English vowels to be obscure. So for the purpose of phonetic scientific work, we cannot afford to have one symbol with two other symbols hidden in it. So we have to use the pure forms, of which we can take the Italian as a type. A, E, I, or U. So in the English word ride, as pronounced by a Cockney, which is of course raid, we have already an obscure situation. So when you said the long vowel E, and then gave me the word alive, you're really turning E into I,
So for the purpose of this word analysis, you must learn to think phonetically. And when you see these symbols, to see them as meaning a, or a, short, long, e, e, I, I, o, o, u, u. Now, an Englishman wouldn't pronounce o like an Italian o, he would say o. And the fusher he was, the more diplomatic he was, the more this thing was an o. So that the fusher he is, the less forthright he is, the more subtle his diplomacy, the more obscure his vowels. Until finally you can't tell one vowel from another. All of which is very useful diplomatically, because there can be a row later about what was really said. Didn't you say we were going for a raid or a ride? And you can't tell. And it's very, very useful. But for our purpose, for scientific reasons, we have to learn these symbols. A, E, I, O, U. Now, because of mental inertia, you'll find that in spite of the fact that you know that you must do this to be scientific, keep one sound, one symbol. In fact, when you look at a word, you will unconsciously, inertically start using the English. So you must break this, otherwise you will never get the meaning of anything properly. So we are saying that there's a relation between the form, visually, and the sound, and the significance. Form, sound, significance. It's obvious in the letter O, it's obvious in the letter E. In the letter U, it doesn't look very obvious unless we make the drawing rather more like this. O throw it through the air. If we take O, which means a sphere, throw it through the air, it will tunnel its way through the air and produce a partial vacuum behind it, and it will be in the shape of a U. So if you project O from the back of your throat forward and protrude your lips, it turns into U. U is a favourite word in chimpanzee. And it corresponds, any more chimp can say, it corresponds with the U in the English word want. You see, there are two U's in want, because U means urge. Push out your lips, you want it. And it's this tendency of the tissues themselves to go towards the object that causes the lips to be protruded. And say, who wanted? Who want? So when you push the lips out, you produce the sign of the letter U from the front of your mouth to the back of the mouth, like that. And you're shooting it out. There's U written on the side. And it means push, drive, urge, and so on. The thicker it is, the more belly-centered it is. And you'll notice that in the more urgible people, the less refined people, that the vowel U is a good thick one. So that you will find the word cup is quite a primitive sounding word. And the people who say cut instead of cat are more likely to cut you than the other ones. They're more urgible. We see that the English word in the northern version of it, in the wilds of Yorkshire and places, where they're not inhibited, they say lull. But if they don't really feel urgeful about it, and they start being intellectual about it, they say lop. And if even their intellect fails, they say lap. Which really means get washed. I've never heard anybody say lep for it, except at a certain meeting. And there was a very, very posh lady speaking, and she'd long ago given it up. So these vowel changes actually spontaneously occur when the significance held in the mind occurs. We'll now go back to the word word. We've seen that the vowels mean something. Here's something for you to work out. Vowel E means a little dot, the tiniest particle, the jot or tittle. The vowel O means a sphere. There's a perspective version of it for you now. That is a sphere. O. It's the O in the mystical word O. Mm. This covers everything. If we put a circle with a dot in the middle, we have written in simultaneous form instead of serial form either a shout of gained power or a complaint for the loss of it. The shout of gained power is from little to big and is called Yo, which is the oldest name we've got of God. And the reverse reading of it, which is called Hebraic reading, after those reversing gentlemen, is called with the hand on the side of the head and the head tilted like an I. It means diminishing in power. So we see in the combination of two letters immediately a suggestion of an increase, Yo, and of a loss, I. Don't forget to put your hand on the side of your head when you do it. Otherwise they'll know that you're a foreigner. Now, these two are very, very obvious, and we've said that the meaning of U is, the nearest single word you can get for it is urge. And the U in love. Notice that when we try to define a single letter, we have to use a word that contains that letter. And the rest of the letters in that same word are added to that primary concept. So if we take the word urge, urge, we have a power going along, it's slightly phallic at the moment, going the wrong way, a word, or the initial letter of a word, that means to differentiate, therefore a power differentiating, and then the old form for earth, ge, which you see in geometry, or geometry. Ge is in good Yorkshire gamma, all gammaed up, block, solid block. You pronounce it as a voiced consonant at the back of your mouth by blocking it, g. And when you say g, you feel that you've got them. The e at the end really means a field. We now have a going, power, urge, and yet the whole meaning of that word is expressed there in the first letter as a going power. Ou, there we are, with a French for you. Va, il va, he goes. And Sanskrit, va, you, the goer, or air. The name of the air spirit, va, you. This part, ou, already means power, going. And the rest of it means the affirming of that power. Now, V and U are the same letter. They differ only in the amount of effort that you use to pronounce them. So there's only one letter in the Hebrew to use for V and U. It is a long letter called Vav, and by Sephardic postures, Wav. Because I don't want to say Vav. It originally is quite simply a drawing of the male genital organ and symbolize push power. Differentiation is an added concept. The gammaed up earth and the field thereof are all added to this primary one of power going somewhere. So to explain U, we had to use another word, urge, and then cross off all the other parts. It's simply the going power. It's the same U in the word power. Only in power, it is turned into O. It's the second letter. But in the French of the same thing, it is retained. There it is. You see that? Pouvoir. To see, power. There's the going part again. Place of the going, power. And because the French are rationalists, they don't think there is any power unless you can see it formally. So to them, pouvoir, you must see that pool because they are rationalists. Now let's go back to the word word again and we'll see what it means. It is two oohs called a double oo, which means power stressed. The ancients used to just simply repeat a word to stress it. If they wanted you to go and keep going. They didn't say go, keep going. They just said go, 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 go. Which sounds a bit Welsh. This double power is simply power intensified. So it's really going with effort. Then it creates a sphere. Then it differentiates inside that sphere by vibrating. And then cuts itself off from the surrounding. So we have... We're going down, aren't we?
Yes, okay.
We have this pushing power going along like this. These are the pushings. And it turns round and makes O. That's O, O, O. And then it goes inside here, rotates, and it's going This is why the word means what it says. It means a power that is going along and sphering itself, driving itself in, vibrating and shaking mightily, and then dividing itself by its own vibrations. There's the original Adam that the apple had to be given to, and it is also the apple that was given to the Adam. This death function means the dividing function. And it occurs spontaneously if the amount of energy put into a thing is so great that it disrupts the form. So, word means a power self-insphering, self-differentiating, self-dividing. So it means the very, very principle of a power that can order. Now let's see. If we take U, R, we've got a primary going and differentiation. Now this is the primitive word that you find, well, it's the name of the place where Abraham used to live, Ur of the Chaldees. It is the word which later is going to change from U to O in the hands of intellectuals and become or in origin. The prefix UR in German means primitive or ancient. So or any given thing, or Mensch, a primitive man. You see, or Sache, a primitive thing. So this or means primitive because it hasn't got a sharp dot in it. It hasn't crystallized itself and defined itself adequately. If we then put an S on the end, you can see already the root of Ursa, of Urs, bear, the great shaggy bear. This is the same bear that a certain star is called after. It's the bear, the still point, the apparent still point, round which the star masses appear to rotate. It is the bearer, and it is also a pun on the shaggy primary energy that has not been compacted to a sharp point. So this Urs and Ors, which is the Italian version of it, you see, Orsi, bears, those shaggy animals. And you know that baby bears traditionally are born with no shape in them, and their mothers have to lick them into shape. So they symbolize primary shaggy energy. So this Ur concept is the power differentiating, the original power differentiating. And the difference between Ur and Or is that in Ur the power has not closed itself, and in Or, in origin, it has closed itself. We can see that if we get the correct significance for every single letter that we can pronounce, we can see why any given word in any language means what it means. Because in each language, the emotional need of expression approximates the organs of speech into certain relations, and then the sound, conditioned by those emotionally determined approximations of the organs, comes out and is the expressed sound equivalent of a predetermining emotion. So we have in the word a mode of emotional analysis, psychological analysis, and mechanical analysis too. So when we come to define a word, we will have to repeat what we've said before about definition. Definition is the finning, or indication of the limits, the fin, the end of things, the limiting factor of things. To define, therefore, is to circumscribe. The essence of definition is circumscription. And we have to here disagree with most of the published logicians who would assert that we define things in the universe. And we insist that we define nothing whatever in the universe. That everything in the universe is already adequately defined, and that we are merely defining all such definitional efforts by indicating the limits of the application of the term. So if we say that the sound symbol O shall be represented by a circle, we open the circle and say that must represent U, the push, then straight away we have merely indicated that we shall use these symbols when given mental contents are present. We are saying nothing whatever about the things in the universe in themselves. We are asserting that we will apply these symbols to signify those things. So we are defining the limits of the application of the terms or symbols. Having said that, we can carry on and proceed to define the limits of the application of any word whatever. Now let's go back a minute to the vowels and see how the change of the vowel can change the significance of a word. Supposing we take the sound K. I'm not using the English letter C for a moment, although there it is in its sharp-pointed version, because it might be pronounced S in English because of their diplomatic capacity for switching things. We'll use this sign that we would call K to symbolize this back palatal or guttural content, simply a closure. Observe that you can whisper it. You can say K. But you can't whisper gay. To make g as k, you have to put tone on it. So we then get a word, and we'll say we get the word cad, and we are seeing here a sound that means closure, but it doesn't mean gross material closure. It symbolizes intellectual closure, conceptual closure. We have a sign here that means absolute energy, non-closed, first letter of the alphabet, the one prior to B, and B is the first letter that you pronounce by closing your lips. So B means closure of the first order. But the R before it means absolute or free energy. Then we take D, the very symbol of D vision. D vision is simply the vision of D. And a divine being is simply a being that can see the differences between things. If you can see where one thing finishes and another begins, then you have divining power. No matter in how small a way you can see this, if you can see the difference of things, then you have a divining capacity. And the divine beings of mythology are simply those beings that can see the differences. And the fool, poloi, poel, poli, and so on, is simply the bloke who can't see the difference between things because he is obsessed with the problem of primitive power. So divine beings are beings who see the difference. Now, when we change R into or we could change intellectual process con, which could mean a fish, or it could mean pull somebody's leg, or the gross material equivalent, simply voicing the K turns it into gay, and you get got. Now this cad, if you remember the myth of Cadmus, cad in tea caddy, which means a little can, actually means a closure with some energy and a division force. So cad, the cardi in the Muslim department, is a controller, a closer, of energy by division. God would be the closure carried to the term of gross material. He has created the earth. He's really locked it up. He has circumscribed it. He's turned the free energy into the bound energy and made macrocosmos. And again, he has divided. He has divided the light from the darkness and the water from the dry land and so on. God, therefore, means that power that creates this earth, circumscribes it, and divides it. All the things in the earth that have been precipitated, each one has had ascribed to it its own field of activity, and each one is clearly demarked so that they don't overlap. The being or force of intelligence that does this is called God. Whereas the intellectual being, doing the same thing, merely in idea, is cod. And this codding somebody is an old reference to this fact. Now you may remember that in the myth of Cadmus, and the moose at the end is like the mouse, and Moses, you know, Moshe, Moses, which means taken out of the water. M for cosmic substance, S for issue. Substantial power issue. Moses is taken out of the water. Water means materiality. That spirit which issues out as a materiality, and in a sense saves you from the material situation, is Moses and is moose. Is the mouse. Remember, the mouse is a little animal that only comes if you are disorderly, to eat up the crumbs that shouldn't be there. It was therefore sacred to the god Apollo. Apollo being the final god, who rationalizes everything and puts it into order. So the mouse is said to be sacred to Apollo, because when he comes, you know that Apollo is annoyed with you, namely you are not tidying up the crumbs properly. Cadmus is credited with the invention of the alphabet. He saves from the material situation the human race by dividing the three energies and locking them up, each in their appropriate place. And you remember in the myth, a dragon is killed, and the teeth of the dragon are sown in the ground, and then they spring up in the form of warriors, and they fight violently until there are only five left, and they would go on to kill each other, only there the fight is stopped. This signifies, by the dragon, your Ur, or primitive energy, which is wiggling about, would devour up every tiny little thing as fast as it came to be. And this dragon is simply your own primary energy. And when you knock it into the ground, you force it into a physical body, you have sown the dragon in there, and the teeth of the dragon are the inherences of its analytical possibilities. Teeth means analysis. Is that right, Eric? You analyze your food better with them than without, in fact. Although I do know a man that's got no teeth and can crack Brazils with his gums, but he's been at it 94 years. They're more like a bird's beak now. So this dragon killed is simply your own primitive energy forced into a gross body, and out of this gross body, the analytical possibilities of the dragon, namely the dragon's teeth, spring up as energies which struggle to manifest themselves. You see this in the way a child tries to walk by thrashing its legs and arms about first. There's no coordination. The energies fly out all at once. When they are coming out, then in the process of the development of this being, they fall into five orders, namely the five sense organs. These are the remaining warriors. At this point of evolution or development, the fight is stopped by certain nuclear forces in it. We stop further development because it's gone far enough. So, this man, credited with the invention of the alphabet, is really a man whose name says he will save you from the material situation by dividing the energies in the situation and locking each one up in accordance with its character and form. So if we analyze that word, we see that it actually means the function of control of a material situation by analysis, and the instrument of it is the alphabet. We know that our alphabet is derived from a primitive alphabet where the initial letters of sounds were used to signify certain animals and plants and so on, and that each animal or plant had a definite symbolic value because it functioned in a certain way. We can say, if we like, that a lion signifies courage, so that we could use a drawing of a lion to represent that quality. We can use a drawing of an arm to represent power, executive. We can use the hand as the actual executive power in process of manipulation. In fact, the man in manipulation is the man's hand. So that in any word we deal with, we can in fact say we have an intensified power creating a zone or sphere of influence which it differentiates and divides up from others. Therefore, by understanding the correct significance of every word, that is, the field in which we must apply it and the limits of its application, we can in fact order our whole substantial being. When we take the human being, and the human being is all really that human beings have to deal with, because of our basic rule, no being knows other than the modifications of its own substance, and therefore a human being knows only the modifications of the human substance. When we look inside ourselves as human beings, we find that we can split the body functionally at certain points. And wherever we find a dividing point naturally, we can say there is a natural division of function. It's quite obvious that the head is separated from the rest of the body and removed away from it a bit by a nexus, a joining thing. And this removal has a function. In the protopathic state of a single-celled animal, there is no power to differentiate the action on the stimulus. So the stimulus rushes right through the whole thing, throws all the being into the form of the stimulus, and the being loses its identity in being overcome by the energy of the stimulus. And that isn't very efficient. We want to increase the efficiency, so we take a little bit of it out and push it up on the stove, and we insulate it, put a hard bone on the outside, so that you can't get at it very well, and we put a tube up to it, and we make sure that not every stimulus gets to it without control. So in the head itself, which means spirit, eater, this eed and eat the same, and this ard root is the same as the ed in edible, and Adonai, the title Lord in the Old Testament,
is really the serpent that eats everything up and then punctuates it. Adonai means this eating up serpent. He's the fellow that assimilates and digests experience. Therefore it is translated Lord, meaning binder of order. In the head or spirit eater we find ideas. You see immediately this e there here. Mistea is a goddess. Here is our little point, precision. Here's a dividing function. Here's a very old form of universal earth, but not gross material. Subtle earth, you see, E-A-R-T-H. This air is the name of an earth goddess, but not as gammed up and grossly compacted, but as a soft, diffuse substance through cosmos. It there means by point division to formulate this substance. So idea is the Greek word which in Latin we translate forma. Form is the Latin idea, idea is the Greek. The Saxon equivalent is shape, which means spirit pushing itself onto a point. So formulation by division is the concept to the Greek mind, because the Greek mind was rational, logical, analytical. In the spirit eater, therefore, there are formal dividing activities of that field energy, which is the absolute substance. Now, when we come down to the bottom, we find that forces which have made their way into the body through food and are broken down in there, before that illumination at the level of idea, they are simply energy packets which are pushing about. They don't know where they want to go. They know only that they are going. So we say the urge level is blind. That blind urge is just pushing out, doesn't know where to go, and will rush about in any environment, and in a closed environment it will bounce off the walls of its enclosure. Imagine now a closed environment, we insert a bit of primary urge into it, a bit of ooh, jumps in, and as soon as it's in it, rushes straight across there, hits the wall, is reflected off. The angle at which it hits that point causes it, by the incidence reflection law, to come over and strike another one. And it does this, it keeps going round, flying round inside. Every time it bangs its head, or the part that it bangs, which later becomes its head, because the thing that becomes a head only becomes so because it's been banged. Every time it bangs there, it has a contraction, which is the point of pain. Remember, pain is point of refusal, P-A-I-N, and it means ein, point of refusal, that the energy flying inside has hit an obstruction. At that moment, it contracts. It is literally contracted by the impact itself. And the contraction is a contraction of the energy of the urge. And that contraction is the same thing as the generation of an idea. This means that every single idea we've got in our head is really a point of pain. You can then see why the Buddhists, who were good psychologists, said that the mind is the organ of fear, because it contains nothing in it except the records of all the painful situations. If you look at the logic of the matter, we can see that if the energy were to travel without meeting an obstacle at all, it would never make anything whatever, because make, mak, means substance, energy, are ke, start, inhibited, mak, ke. This substantial energy has been stopped. So if it doesn't get stopped, it doesn't make. It is an eternal search with no object. There's no object until you end sphere. The ob in object means the sphere. So imagine this energy coursing infinitely and eternally, meeting nothing, meeting no obstacle. Therefore, it can never contract. It has no ground for it. It's not going to meet an opposition. And therefore, it will be simply an awareness, because power is sentience, of a searching without any finding. You know, Jacob Boehmer's description of this is a searching with no finding. It is an eternal coursing that comes to no end. It is a search. Now, consequently, if we are to create any value whatever, we must rotate some of this power to create an obstacle. And as soon as we rotate the power, we have made an obstacle, both inside and out. As soon as this rotation gets up speed, an energy from outside is reflected off it. And therefore, it is opaque to outside me. And at the same time, if there's any energy inside it, it reflects off the inside of the wall, and it is opaque to energies on the inside trying to get out. When Christ says, "When you've done your work, you shall go no more out," he's referring to a certain application of this. And when it is said that God spewed out of his mouth certain elements, again a reference is made to this fact. At every point where the energy hits against the obstacle on the inside, the energy is constricted a little bit and is moved in that constriction towards the level that we refer to when we use the word idea. Now, prior to the induction of this flying energy, we can talk about the general protoplasmic feeling level of a unified being. It's simply feeling, field awareness. Feeling is field awareness. But as soon as the energy is inserted into it, and then in entering, breaking the barrier, the surrounding wall, it loses a bit of energy as it crosses that, and is therefore slowed down. When it hits the wall on the other side, it may not have sufficient energy to break right through. If it hasn't, it is reflected again, and again it loses a little bit of energy. Every time it does this, just as a gas losing energy contracts, liquefies, and then solidifies. So, this energy, which was primary or energy, coming in, is progressively contracted and finally finishes up creating a circle of contracted energy. This contracted energy is what you mean by an idea. This idea, therefore, is simply the compacted self-objectification of a series of painful incidents. You can see that if you were omnipotent, you wouldn't bother to think, because you could command all your desires to be fulfilled immediately. But if in fact you come up against situations where you are in a constriction and your energy is reduced by the impact, you contract progressively more and more, and you are driven to formulate your position. But the evidence for the idea in you is the same as the evidence for a loss of field consciousness. As you contract onto the idea, you are losing field awareness of your whole being. This means that if you concentrate on an empirically derived idea, that is, on an idea coming from your five senses, you are automatically, and by so doing, reducing your general awareness of your being, in fact robbing yourself of the whole field awareness which you need to understand the very thing you're looking at. So if you isolate a single idea clearly in your mind, so that you can't feel it because you're so concentrated on it, at that moment it becomes meaningless. Doesn't matter what the idea is, as soon as you isolate it by contracting it, so that it goes out of relation with the rest of your being, its clarity is the same thing as this utter meaninglessness. So that if you come to the level of being a true Bertrand Russell, then you will find that you can't understand the meaning of your propositions. They're very, very clear, but they don't mean anything.
So that if you drive yourself to ideological clarity, like a left-wing theorist does, like a thoroughgoing Marxist is a materialist who believes in little jots of matter, at the moment you isolated jots of matter, you immediately fail to see any significance whatever in it. The only way you can get your significance back is to posit the dot and then withdraw from it and regain the field of consciousness which generated it. Then you see that it is the objectification functionally of a need that sprang in feeling. And this field awareness is what we mean by femaleness. But the idea awareness is what we mean by maleness. So you can see that the progression from a field state, female, to a formed, contracted idea state, male, is really a progressive loss of feeling power in the attempt to gain clarity of idea. This means that the being that forgets its field awareness while it is pursuing idea will become what it believes to be a male, that is to say, will be ideologically formed. But in losing its field awareness, the thing that it knows will have no meaning. And therefore, the mere male losing the female side of himself, his feeling side, has lost all significance. And this is why Christ says that the proper state of man after death, when he's realized himself, is the state of a hermaphrodite, a male hermaphrodite, because he's taken his field consciousness and involved it in a situation and formulated at its center, but he has retained the field awareness. In the Tao Te Ching, you get the same thing stated: he who can become a man, an idea, and yet remain a woman, the generative field of their idea, has finished his work. Now, the pursuit of the idea frequently results in progressive contractions of consciousness and the loss of the feeling. And this puts the man out of relation with the woman in himself, and therefore out of relation with the woman outside himself. But if he goes outside the relation of feeling in himself, significance ceases for him, and he dries up. So that to gain the hermaphroditic condition described by Christ, for every idea that you have, you should learn to walk backwards and rediscover the generating field state, causative of it. If you don't, then you'll become very, very clear that you'll be utterly out of relation with other beings. Probably there's no greater clarity than the idea of a billiard ball and of another billiard ball, of a simple continuum of solid matter, if such were to exist. We know that it doesn't, but as a conceptual possibility, if we place two ball bearings in a vacuum, they have no relation whatever. We have to formulate that relation, and we can only do it by feeling across the interspace between. Therefore, we say that meaning is the relation between, and the mean is that which goes between. All meaning is between two points which are in themselves meaningless. So if you destroy the feeling between things, you are destroying the meaning, because meaning is actually field consciousness of the state between any two points. The two points themselves, insofar as they are conceived to be separated, have no relation. And if you remove the field awareness, then they are completely out of relation and therefore void of meaning. If you put back the field awareness, you can then feel the contribution of each point, because it is vibrating, across the field. And the way the vibration of point A and point B cross in the field can only be experienced in the field. So they're mutual effects on each other. Their vibrational interrelations in the field can only be felt in the field, and therefore meaning is in the field and nowhere else. Now, when we look at the word mean, we are looking at a series of symbols, which means substance, the M, E, the field, A, the energy, N, the motion. So it says substantial field energy moving. So if you want meaning, you must increase the feeling of your substance. You must find inside your substance that there is motion, N, energy, R, field awareness, A, and M, the substance. So if you actually get hold of your hand, close it tightly, shut your eyes and feel the amount of contraction in it. You're not looking at it, so it's not visual form. You are feeling the amount of R, energy, in air, the field, by the substance which you believe to be flesh, but really it is universal substance, is moving in a certain manner. And when you get hold of this substantial field awareness and the energy motion within it, you've got hold of meaning. And if you remove the substantial field energy motion from consciousness, you have destroyed meaning. You can consider a point, and you can do a Euclidean trick on it, reduce it to a mere abstraction. You can define a Euclidean point as location without dimension, and then the thing ceases to exist completely. But you have a concept of a zone in which there is no thing, but there is location. Now you're doing an intellectual trick on yourself to do it. And in the process, you are introducing a meaningless entity. Because there is no feeling in an intellectual Euclidean point, which has location and no dimensions. Having no dimensions, it has no substance. Also, for geometrical considerations, it is not a point of energy. It is merely a locus, positive conception. So that the geometrical analysis, destroyed of its feeling, awareness becomes totally meaningless. So the Parmenidian sphere of the universe as a geometrical proposition, divorced from all substantial field energy motion, becomes static and therefore meaningless. So we see that by moving the symbols about a bit within the words, we can force into consciousness certain concepts that we could not otherwise get at. A word split discovers, like a split atom, energies within it, and these energies you gain every time you split a word. In the head, the spirit eater, we have some ideas which are forms. In the bottom level, we have a primary urge which is crying because it's all gammed up. And when the urge rises up and strikes its head against the wall, or where it strikes becomes its head, because it becomes negated, as it's striking and flying, the feeling state between the two, the points of impact and the points of translation of energy, is what we call feeling. So the feeling mediates between the point of impact, the idea, and the point of translation, the urge. So we can then divide up all the concepts of consciousness in the human being in these three manners. We must consider them as form, as power, and as a field awareness of the relation between form and power. And then we have a word which is used, spine, here. Now, you can see immediately the word spin in it, and actually, if it were not the spinning forces inside the developing being, the spine would never be laid. There are forces that move and spin and travel along, and they lay the spinal axis. They're actually rotating forces. The spine is the zone of the spinning forces, similar to the apple diagram we did down below, where the forces enter in and progressively divide. Along this zone here, when these forces rotating and these meet, there is built up a spin zone. That spin zone is the zone which we call the spine, and it means spinning field, spin field. And along these spins are precipitated the calcium which becomes the bones of the spine. So we see that the human being can then be divided into these three levels of activity: power activity, form activity, and meaning which is field consciousness of relation between power and idea. And these are coordinated on the spina, or spine, that draws in these three levels of function together and weaves them, knits them together, the lines of force. And spinning them together, therefore, produces a peculiar synthesis of idea and power in the field itself. Therefore, the more central spinal consciousness you get, the more coordination power you've got. Remember the diagram we did of a fall on one occasion, where the man himself, in the head, looking out on the world, is hit by a stimulus, which may have references sexual or appetite, and the consciousness then goes down here, and the actual descent from the head downwards is called the fall. The lowest point of consciousness of a balanced man never goes below his diaphragm. He's quite happy to allow the urge to come up here, to meet it with the idea, and to resolve the relation idea and urge across here. The unfallen man didn't have a power more subtly in his body than his diaphragm. The diaphragm parts the body in the middle, and what is below it is called the hell. And down below the diaphragm level are all sorts of horrible chemical processes, hellish processes. You know what it's like in a schoolboy's laboratory, and they're making horrible noises and horrible stinks all day long for fun. This is what goes on below the diaphragm level. So the whole of the chemical processes below the diaphragm are better unconscious. If you were to descend into that level, you can do it as an exercise if you like. When you've done it, you'll be glad to come back again. You will hear, smell, and taste, and feel the most horrible, hellish activities, where atoms are being split, all sorts of bangs are occurring, terrible smells of chemical releases are going on all the time. And out of these, out of this hellish force below the diaphragm, release the energies which, when they climb up, become ideas and clarity. And experience here, where the air meets the blood in the lungs, generate the field forces which become the processes of thought. So the fall is always a fall downwards, down the spinal column. And the front part of your body is furnished with soft stuff for sensual experiences. The back part not so much. So when the fall occurs downwards, because of the fact that the nerves in the spine move forwards as they go down, so the fall is down and forwards into appetite and sexual department. To pick yourself up, therefore, you have to take yourself back and up. So every time you pull your consciousness from below, upwards and backwards, between your shoulder blades and then up to the head, you have gained in control power. Whereas if you deliberately identify your field, drag it out of your head and pull it down, below the diaphragm and push it well forward and sit on it and keep it there, then you begin to feel as you're degenerating. Certainly something's going to go on that will not be the essence of control. Now you can do these exercises for yourself to see that it really does happen. If it doesn't, you'll have to write a special book for yourself. But I'd like to read it. If it does, you can count yourself as pretty human, because it actually does go on with all human beings. So, very shortly, we will say that the word is a mode of ordering power. W is to power. We're going to order power. Word means mode of ordering power. The definition of a word is the indication of the limits of its application. It is not a definition of a thing external. It is the indication of the limits of its application. And that the meaning of anything whatever can only be discovered by becoming field conscious
and discovering the power, U, which precipitated itself into a closure, O, and then in that contracted to E, and thus became idea. And therefore, every idea, if you disperse it through the field, will become a feeling and disclose an original urge which generated the idea. So that when you start to analyze an idea and break it down, you are discovering further ideas. But when you start feeling round an idea, you're discovering the field that generated it. And when you come to the ooh level, the first push of it, you have discovered what is called the motive behind the idea. The ooh is the motive behind the E. So J, the J O E, J and I are the same letter in the Hebrew, the Yom sign is I and J. Yip, affirm, and Ju, E U, Ju, and the English word you, the subject who sees things, simply means that point of power which is aware of everything. So if you say, ooh, I, which sounds terribly English, different on English, and you aspirate it, why? That's a question. Why are these things? W-H-Y. Universe it if you want the reply. Affirm spiritual power. That's Y-H-W, which translated in the Bible is called Jehovah. So Jehovah simply means the affirming spiritual power. So if you want to know the why of anything, we are really asking a psychological question about the affirmative spiritual power that brought it into being. And if you want to know how, you are concerned with the spiritual field closure of the power, and therefore with the mechanical proposition. So we say that the word how refers to the mechanics, the mode of doing it, and why refers to the psychological motive at the back of it, which is always the affirmation of some spiritual power. Can it be 10 o'clock?
You say there's always pain associated with formation of an idea.
Yes.
And what about the ideas which are pleasurable?
The idea of pleasure is the same as the idea of a hammer that you start putting yourself there. You don't have an idea associated with pleasure prior to having the pleasure taken off you. It is not formulated as an idea. A child doesn't formulate its pleasure fluxes as ideas until mummy whips the thing out of his lips. Then the formulation begins, but not before.
Well, you can have an idea of sexual activity which indicates pleasure to you. That it's never been satisfied.
Indicates pleasure.
Yes.
You can't have an idea of it unless it's not being pleasurable. You had a bit of pleasure and then it ceased. There's some obstacle somewhere. This causes the formulation of the idea. You haven't got an idea of a pleasure unless you had this pleasure interfered with. It's the interference that sharpens it and contracts it and makes it into an idea. Pre-layer, the laying out of the thing, gently, is not formulated as idea. You have no clear idea whatever is the question.
No, you're not a clear idea.
No, because you haven't been contracted. The only things you have clear ideas about are pains.
You have an idea nevertheless, sir.
It's only the idea that has arisen from a pain encroaching on the pleasure. It says so far the pleasure ceases. It's the pain that has defined the limit of the pleasure, not the pleasure that has defined its own limit. It's a good exercise for you. Try to define pleasure without.